So in this short lecture, I'm going to talk about the situation in Hong Kong. In contrast to China's inner Asian regions that we talked about in the previous lecture, Hong Kong, and you can include nearby Macau, are tiny territories that are populated mostly by Han Chinese, and for the most part, their residents, up until recently, inhabited sort of dual identities as citizens of both the People's Republic of China and their distinctive local systems. They are economically and culturally tied to the mainland, but they were supposed to enjoy institutions and ways of life rooted in their histories as colonies of Britain and Portugal, respectively. And the two territories were successfully reintegrated into China as special administrative regions. Hong Kong was in 1997, Macau in 1999. But in the process of regaining control, especially over Hong Kong, China had to sign on to treaty obligations and broader political commitments not to govern the returned colonies the same way that it governs elsewhere in its territory. Now, China needs to hang on to these territories because losing control there could challenge the regime's ability to rule on the mainland. And that possibility is not imminent, but it's real thanks to the legacies of the takeover, where you have these independent local institutions that could have the capability to challenge Beijing's rule. You have local dissatisfaction that flares up in massive protests from time to time. You have treaty-based rights to foreign countries which can protest and implement sanctions if China violates the special rights of the people of Hong Kong. And a further constraint is the possibility that a mishandled crisis in Hong Kong could alienate the public in Taiwan. So Hong Kong Island and the small peninsula of Kowloon were ceded to Britain as colonies in two 19th century treaties after the Opium Wars in the mid-19th century. The other 90% of what we consider the Hong Kong administrative region consists of an area called the New Territories that Britain leased in 1898 for a period of 99 years, and neither Hong Kong nor the nearby enclave of Macau was ever considered viable as an independent state. And so probably for this reason, for years, Beijing gave little urgency to their recovery. And even though Britain legally held Hong Kong Island and Kowloon in perpetuity, it wouldn't have made any sense to keep them without the New Territories, whose lease was due to run out in 1997. So in 1982, the British raised the possibility of extending the lease, but Deng Xiaoping rejected that offer and said, no, in fact, we would actually appreciate the return of sovereignty to China. So China had economic and political interests in a smooth transition. Hong Kong was a regional financial center and entrepot. It had a GDP at the time worth about 20% of all of mainland China's GDP. Hong Kong capitalists were the largest foreign investors in China. They employed an estimated 3 million mainlanders in factories whose products were trucked to Hong Kong's state-of-the-art container terminals for transshipment to the United States and other markets. Multinational corporations used the territory as their base for mainland business activities. And Hong Kong has continued to be economically crucial. So as of 2009, for example, Hong Kong was China's third largest trading partner after the United States and Japan. And was still China's top source of foreign direct investment inflows. The spread of mainland corruption to Hong Kong, or a disruption of Hong Kong's sophisticated financial and communications and transportation and legal infrastructure, the threat was always that would drive the lucrative foreign presence to another regional center like Singapore or Tokyo or maybe even Taipei. And that would undercut efforts to liberalize the economy at home. So for all of these reasons, Deng Xiaoping offered the formula of one country, two systems, which was then formalized in the Sino-British Joint Declaration of 1984. And China promised that Hong Kong would enjoy a high degree of autonomy for at least 50 years after retrocession in 1997, that it would be governed by Hong Kong people, and that China would preserve Hong Kong's social and economic systems and basically leave them unchanged. A basic law, or it's sort of like a mini constitution, was adopted by China's legislature in 1990 that provided for Hong Kong's evolution toward fully democratic direct elections of the chief executive and the legislature at some unspecified time in the future. And meanwhile, it set up complex electoral arrangements that basically guaranteed Beijing's control over the choice of chief executive and a majority of the legislature. And there was then a separate, similar Chinese agreement with Portugal that provided for the return of Macau. So between the agreement and the return of Hong Kong to Chinese control in 1997, events in Hong Kong started to create a whole bunch of challenges for Beijing. So the Chinese understood that the joint declaration implied that they would basically inherit the executive-led structure that the British had found so workable in governing Hong Kong as a colony for 150 years. And since Beijing would appoint the chief executive, it could expect to dominate the local government as easily as London had done. Beijing also expected the Hong Kong people to be as pragmatic and apolitical as they had pretty much always been. But unexpectedly, you had these huge protests and a violent repression of them in 1989 in Tiananmen Square, which actually galvanized the development of a democratic movement in Hong Kong, which then in turn motivated Britain to move Hong Kong as far towards democracy as possible before they handed it back in 1997. So as the territory's last British governor, the British government installed a populist politician, Chris Patten, who proposed to empower all Hong Kong citizens above the age of 18 with a direct vote for legislative council representatives, to also create a legislative majority of directly elected members. So these are radical reforms in the context of the existing colonial system. And so the Chinese interpreted this as essentially a Trojan horse that Britain was trying to insert into Hong Kong, that essentially Britain was trying to set up a transfer of a turbulent, democratizing Hong Kong that was susceptible to Western influence before the handover. So in Beijing's view, to tolerate this kind of dissent or disorder would have given encouragement to the democracy movement at home. It might also inspire separatists in Tibet, Xinjiang, and Taiwan. And so China decided to respond toughly, basically denouncing the reforms as they were carried out, and then rolling them back by decree as soon as it took over the territory in 1997. China garnered a whole bunch of support from a pro-China business community that, because they did so much business with the mainland, tended to toe Beijing's line. China maintained the indirect election system that gave it ultimate say over choice of chief executive and the makeup of the legislative council majority. And then it put off the promise of direct elections to the indefinite future. So you could argue that it was sort of a victory for China at the time, but despite this victory, Hong Kong has of course remained a massive political problem for Beijing for several reasons. For one, from the Cold War through to the present, Hong Kong has been known as a hotbed of Western intelligence collection on China, as well as Chinese counterintelligence efforts. The number of British spies in Hong Kong reportedly increased after the handover. And Hong Kong's unique post-handover status included bilateral agreements that gave access to foreign government agencies that were beyond Beijing's direct control. So this, of course, plays into China's longstanding fears of foreign attempts to stimulate political unrest in China. Another issue is that pro-democracy activism and criticism of the Communist Party in Hong Kong, which is subject to severe punishment in the rest of China, were big nuisances for the Chinese central government. So there's always this sort of liberal sentiment that remained dormant, but potentially a very powerful force in Hong Kong after the handover. And you had press freedoms that were supposed to be guaranteed by Hong Kong's Bill of Rights that ensured a media that was much more critical of the Chinese Communist Party than what you'd get, obviously, from the pro-Beijing media outlets on the mainland. And yet another issue is that for Beijing is that it was especially concerned about observers in Taiwan who would be quick to seize on any indication that China was reneging on its one country, two systems promise to say, look, this is why we can't deal with the mainland. And, you know, we've had this most recent crisis in 2020, but I think it's important to point out there's been other crises and massive protests in Hong Kong pushing back against Beijing's rule. So one of those came in July of 2003, where you had nearly 500,000 people, which is about at the time was about 10% of Hong Kong's population, take to the streets, and they were protesting the proposed legislation that China was trying to put forward against sedition and subversion. So these were known as the national security laws that are required by a very controversial article of China, of Hong Kong's basic mini constitution, Article 23. So the crowd that gathered was so thick that some waited hours just to get into central Hong Kong's Victoria Park, which was the official starting point. So just to get the chance to participate and be counted in this historical moment, people stood in line for hours, essentially. And the Hong Kong government underestimated the number of protesters they thought would turn out by a factor of 10. Democracy leaders then set their sights on the September of 2004 elections in the legislature. They hoped to win a majority in 2004, which they thought would then greatly increase their bargaining power in pushing for universal suffrage in the 2007-2008 elections. So some scholars called this period in the 2000s the rebirth of democracy movement, and 81% of respondents in Hong Kong supported the idea of universal suffrage for chief executive elections in 2007, as well as for the Legislative Council in 2008. So China had to deal with this massive crisis, and it launched a comprehensive response. For one thing, Beijing continued to push several economic programs with Hong Kong, basically in making it easier for mainland tourists to visit Hong Kong, setting up a program to integrate Hong Kong's economy with the nearby Pearl River Delta, basically trying to create to amplify the pro-China business community within Hong Kong. A second aspect of China's strategy was that central authorities started a propaganda campaign against the democracy movement, and they enlisted the aid of mainland's legal experts, where they basically emphasized Beijing's position that any reform needs to be gradual for the sake of stability. And the focus of the propaganda campaign soon became about sort of patriotism. You know, paying homage to a Deng Xiaoping maxim that Hong Kong would be governed with quote unquote patriots as the main body. So this idea that, look, you are part of China and you need to respect the, you need to worship essentially the nation. So, you know, there's these bruising conflicts that attended the Hong Kong transition, and it really demonstrated China's vulnerability in a world where economic interests and the power of ideas have become as important as military power. China could have taken Hong Kong long before it did most recently by basically turning off the water. It has lots of ways to influence Hong Kong. And it chose to negotiate a peaceful transfer because its interests in the territory were so heavily entwined with foreign interests. And when faced by challenges from Britain and the Hong Kong people, China, you know, at that time managed the situation carefully instead of cracking down harshly and paying the price in relations with other powers. But now that strategy is basically being thrown out. China, of course, has moved in to pass these stringent national security laws that basically make Hong Kong, for all intents and purposes, now is being folded into mainland China's judicial system and is going to be run by China's police force, which is going to have a massive presence in Hong Kong. And China can interpret these laws in pretty much any way it sees fit. So it can deem anything sort of subversion by the Hong Kong people and use that to prosecute people that live within Hong Kong. China, even in its national security laws, says that it can prosecute foreigners, even those that are outside of Hong Kong or China are potentially supposedly subject to this law, in the sense that China reserves the right to prosecute them for basically stirring up trouble and splittism and subversion. So these are sweeping changes. They're clearly a rejection of the treaty obligations that China signed on to in 1984 that were supposed to govern the handover. They clearly are a renege on the one country, two systems maxim that Deng Xiaoping had put into place, where China was supposed to keep a hands-off approach to Hong Kong until 2047. They clearly renege on the promise to eventually move towards universal suffrage for the chief executive and the legislative council. And for all intents and purposes, Hong Kong is, you know, on its way to becoming just another Chinese city. So the international community, you know, has various cards to play. So Britain, Australia, Taiwan are basically trying to make it so that Hong Kong residents can move and have a path to citizenship even in outside of Hong Kong. So basically an evacuation. The United States may be about to do the same. There's also talk of international sanctions being placed on China, where particular Chinese officials that are found to be part of the crackdown or those that are seen to be implementing these new national security laws can be subject to sanctions, meaning that they could be denied visas to, you know, say the United States or Britain or whatever countries impose the sanctions. They could have their assets in foreign bank accounts frozen. If they are involved with companies, those companies could be cut out of the dollar clearing system, which governs 90% of international trade. So there's a lot of talk of really trying to turn the screw, at least on particular individuals. It's unclear at this moment how broadly that those kind of sanctions will be applied, whether they'll just be slapped on very high-level Chinese officials, or whether, you know, even police officers that are enforcing these laws can be subject to them. So a lot remains to be seen, but I think the bottom line is China has made its position clear that it's, it is reincorporating Hong Kong, which for all intents and purposes is now a Chinese city, and its once independent or sort of quasi-independent system is rapidly being squelched.